We've all done it. Stock our fridge with good intentions, only to sacrifice nutrition for convenience. Keep your body and mind nourished with whole body meal shakes from Kachava. It's got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. But it actually tastes delicious. Try one of Kachava's indulgent flavors today. Shop now through December 2nd to get 30% off your first purchase of 2 or more bags. Go to kachava.com and use code NEWS. That's KACHAVA.com, code NEWS.
Go Loud. Magnified with Matt Cooper. Sponsored by Intact Insurance, the new name for RSA Insurance, and a new way to insure business with ease.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Hello, and we're back for a new series of Magnified with thanks to Intact Insurance. You may know Intact Insurance by another name, RSA Insurance. Now, there's a reason for the change of name. For brokers, this means deeper engagement and enhanced product offerings across personal and commercial lines. So remember the name. It's now Intact Insurance, and Intact Insurance has big plans for Ireland. It wants to be one of the top three insurers in the Irish market by 2030. And here on Magnified, we're delighted to be part of that journey. Our new series of podcasts follows the format of old for Magnified, considered interviews of longer duration than the format of radio and The Last Word Allows Me. On this episode of Magnified, we have a very different type of interview, but one that I found absolutely enthralling. Just such a different life story from this person about all the places that he's been and the circumstances in which he has gone there and the work that he's done and the work that has to be done. He's recently become the chief executive of Trocara, which is a name that would be familiar to, I suspect, all of you. But he's going to tell us about the work that he's done with the organization in a career of over 30 years and now what he hopes to do as the new chief executive, particularly putting a focus on places like Sudan, which perhaps to the embarrassment and shame of us in the media, we do not pay enough attention to the genocide that is going on there in that country. There are places beyond Ukraine and Gaza, which Trocara does a lot of good work in both of those locations as well. But that's a preamble to listening to him tell you about all of that. I'm delighted that our guest on Magnified this week, the new chief executive of Trocara, Sean Farrell. And again, our thanks to Intact Insurance. Our guest on Magnified today is the man who's just been appointed as chief executive of one of Ireland's biggest aid agencies and charities, Trocara. Sean Farrell, thank you very much for joining us. Am I correct in describing Trocara as a charity and an aid agency?
Yes, I think you're correct in describing it as both. I think we use the terms both about Trocara. We are an aid agency. We work across Latin America, Africa and Asia, running large aid programs. And we're also a charity in that we accept charitable donations from the people of Ireland and other donors to do our work.
Who are the other donors?
So about a third of our income comes from the Irish public, collected through parishes, schools, individual donors. About a third of our income comes from the Irish government, from the official Overseas Development Aid Programme, Irish Aid, and about a third of our income comes from other donors such as European Union, other European governments, UN agencies, etc.
How big is Trocara now? How many people do you have working with you? What's the size of your budget?
So the budget this year is about 85 million euros. So it's a substantial organisation. We have about 500 staff, but I would say the staffing is relatively small given the size of the budget. And the reason for that is the way that we work. So since Trocara was founded, we have worked with local organisations on the ground rather than implementing directly. So if you look at our operations across the world, we have 500 people, 75% are nationals of the countries where we work, particularly in Africa. And those small staff numbers will work with a whole range of local organisations who are implementing programmes. I suppose we've always believed in locally led development, that people are the authors of their own development, and therefore the way we work is not to implement programmes largely using our own staff, but to work through and with local organisations who are doing the work. And that ranges from human rights organizations in places like Guatemala, Honduras, to local organizations implementing food and health services in places like Sudan, South Sudan, Somalia today, right to local organizations working in Myanmar under very trying circumstances with the military junta, to local organizations working for human rights in Zimbabwe. So right across the world, we work with these organizations, build their capacity and fund them.
And the use of local staff, is that to negate any suggestion of the, you know, the phrase, the white saviours coming in, telling people in other parts of the world, this is how you do it?
Yeah, and for me, it is about development being locally owned. And it is about ensuring that as an organisation that we're in the front line of ensuring that the countries that we work in, that the people of that country are ultimately responsible and hold their own development. So across the world where we work, if I look at, say, for example, our staff in Somalia, working in health centres, in hospitals, working with local organisations, 98% of our staff there are Somali. If I look at our staff in Zimbabwe, you know, our human rights staff that are working with human rights organisations, very difficult work, but they are Zimbabweans who are working in that context. And it is part of that whole process of seeing development as being locally owned and locally run.
When you say working with and it being difficult work, what sort of work does Trokra do?
So I would describe it, I suppose, in two ways. One is life-saving and the other is life-changing. So if I look at it from my own perspective of having sort of been in this area of work for 30 years now, the first part is our humanitarian work, which is life-saving work in critical emergency situations. One can think of, say, Sudan today, which is in the middle of a horrendous crisis. And that work is basic nutrition. It's sometimes food aid. Medical supplies. It's the work that supports people at their weakest moments and their moments of huge crisis. I would consider that the life-saving work. But for Trokra, the other work that we do is not just responding to the needs of poverty, but asking the underlying questions around why people are poor. And that gets into our work, as we would call it, our work for justice and human rights. And that's been part of the organization's history. If I look back to the organization working on issues like apartheid, working on issues like, say, the military dictatorships in Latin America, and working with groups who were opposing the huge human rights abuses. If I think about my own work in, say, a country like Zimbabwe, so I ran a human rights program in Zimbabwe for Trokra during the end of the Mugabe era, where our local organizations were being picked up, tortured, some disappeared. There was a number of murders of people who were in that human rights space, because what they were essentially doing was shining a light on the abuses in the Mugabe regime, the huge amount of murders, tortures, and just the complete absence of any rule of law in large parts of the country. And our local organizations were in the forefront of that. I remember sitting with a human rights lawyer who was Zimbabwean at that time, and this was a time when we expected, you know, the soldiers to be coming across the wall, to be really honest, because our local organizations were under huge pressure. And what she often said that stuck with me was that the work that they were doing, they couldn't make a lot of progress because they regime was so tight and so difficult, but that they were shining a light on the abuses that were happening, and that that had an intrinsic value in itself. So I've often seen Trokra's work as being both, that it is about life-saving work in the immediate, but it's also about the work around justice and human rights that underpins all of our work.
How much danger did you feel you were in yourself in Zimbabwe?
I felt our local organisations were in much more danger. I felt that what was likely to happen to me was that they would come across the wall, take me and land me at the airport and deport me. That's what I felt. But in a lot of the situations we work in, I think of, you know, my colleagues in Sudan today, speaking to them last week, who are in the Nuba Mountains, a part of the country that's now the active conflict is increasing there day by day. Think about, you know, our staff in Somalia, where they're under constant travel bans, where we can't go from one area where we work to the other because of attacks from Al-Shabaab. And I suppose I look back then to times where I spent 6 years in Uganda, particularly working in northern Uganda. So when I moved to Uganda in 2007, if you can imagine, the northern part of the country had just gone through a 20-year war, 1.9 million people living in camps. These were all displaced, many of them displaced for a whole generation. And the camps were just shocking, dirty, horrible, squalid places where disease was rampant. And there wasn't a peace agreement, but there was, I suppose what I would say is, an end to the active fighting between the government of Uganda forces and the Lord's Resistance Army. And I remember walking through those camps as people were beginning to think about making the journey home. And a lot of our work at that stage was helping people to transition home. But home to them, they were going back to areas that were overgrown with bushes and trees. Their houses had been destroyed. Their schools had been absolutely decimated. There was no health centres. It was almost like starting life again. And for us, it was always that dual approach of immediate needs, helping people with water points, helping people getting agriculture back up and running, but also the systemic justice issues that began to emerge. One was that as the move home happened, women started losing land en masse. So if your husband died while you were in the camp, and there had been huge levels of killing, as you move back home, if you were a woman or you were the eldest child was a daughter, you were pushed off your land by male relatives or other stronger men from the area. So we started a huge program around women's land rights, helping them to document their land and making sure that it was always, so there's a sense for me that at the moment where peace was almost present was when the greatest losses were happening for women in particular. That they'd spent 20 years displaced in a camp, living in horrendous conditions, and now at the moment of peace they were going to lose what was theirs, which was their basic land rights, which gave them their future livelihood options. So I suppose when I think about that time, the Lord's Resistance Army was an army of child soldiers, largely. They had gone village to village and they'd rounded up children. I think the scariest times for me was facing kids with guns, I have to be honest, because there is something about the process of kidnapping children, then brutalizing them. And kids will do things that adults will not do because they are so brutalized. And what the Lord's Resistance Army did in those camps was to take their kids, brutalize them, and then turn those kids back on those communities so that it almost wedded them to the movement forever. So it was, so I suppose the scariest times for all of us was meeting children with guns and knowing the unpredictable nature of that.
Sean, does this not give you a very depressing feel about humanity, about what so many people are like, that they resort to violence and murder almost at a whim?
I think, like, when I look back at, so I started in this work in 1992, it's a long time ago. I think some of us that went in to this sort of work at that time did 6 months or a year, and people felt they had contributed, and that was brilliant. Yeah. And they got a huge sense of self, I suppose, self-purpose from that. And they contributed something and learned a lot themselves from it. I suppose those of us who've stuck with it long term, I think you have to be a glass half full sort of person. So if I think about myself walking through a camp in Somalia where people have just been displaced and, you know, the fighting is active, and they're living under trees, putting up a blanket, and they've no food and no water. My immediate impression is, what can we do? And what can I do in this situation? What money can I mobilise from Throkra? What can we get tankers of water to this area? Can we get food supplies going? You know, so I suppose the way I meet situations is around, you know, we can make a difference. We do make a difference in our work, and we continue to make a difference. And I've also seen huge positive changes in the world. Like, I think about the northern Uganda that I started working in, and then the northern Uganda I left 6 years later, and walking through farms where people had rebuilt their lives despite the absolute horror that they came from. You know, a horror of a vicious war, you know, an army of child soldiers, huge levels of violence, particularly against women. And seeing those women go back, seeing families move back and create new lives was transformational in many ways. And us as Throkra being one part of that, with our local organisations and local communities, seeing people create life again, seeing, you know, I can remember walking through fields with families where they were growing crops again, they were feeding themselves, the kids were going to school. And this was in a relatively short period of time, 6 years. So I suppose that's what's always kept me going. And even though, you know, unfortunately in the world we live in, the work takes us to, you know, you might describe it as the ugliest sides of what we see in humanity. You know, like, can remember being in Rwanda a lot after the genocide, can, you know, walk through the villages in Myanmar in the aftermath of the attacks on communities in Myanmar. So we do see the ugliest side of human nature. But I also think we see the best side, and that keeps us going. We see incredible bravery. We see incredible work by the local organisations we work with. I see, you know, in my own staff in Throkra, a huge commitment to the work. I see people really trying to make a difference and trying to make the world a better place. So I suppose it's always that balance. And I think you've almost need to be sort of glass half full to do it long term, or you wouldn't stick with it.
But do you ever get depressed by what you see?
Not depressed. I'd say I get annoyed and angry and like dealing with what we're dealing with now globally, I'd say at the large scale is a bit depressing. So if you look at what's happened in the last year, so global aid flows are collapsing.
And I want to talk to you about USAID, and I want to talk about Sudan in particular, which is the genocide that gets ignored a lot of the time, unfortunately, here in Ireland. But I want to find out a little bit more about you, Sean, beforehand. I mean, what brought you into this in the first place? Why did you decide? I mean, you mentioned that some people did 6 months for a year, volunteer almost, and I know people have done that. But why did you decide that you wanted this to be your career?
I don't think I did, the first honest answer. So I think
of this... where are you from originally?
I'm from North Longford. So I'm from a parish called Dromard in North Longford, which sits on the Longford-Cavan border. I went to school in a school called Moyne, which is a community school in a rural area of North Longford. Students from Longford, Cavan and Leitrim. Great GAA battles back in the day, Matt, in that place. And I suppose some of this obviously came from my parents. You know, there was always a sense, you know, we grew up on a small farm, but there was always a sense that looking after your neighbour, looking after others was part of how our family operated. My mum, you know, particularly was very strong in the local community, very strong in the church, gave lots of her time to lots of things in the church. So there's part of that. I learned almost subconsciously as a young boy growing up. When I volunteered in Romania, I thought I would do it for a period of time, you know, 6 months to a year. But I would have to say that this was 1992. Ceausescu was killed, the former dictator, in Christmas 1989. And we remember the scenes of the walls coming down and the sort of sense that Eastern Europe was tasting freedom. But on the ground, it didn't feel like that. Like the equivalent of the KGB, which in Romania was Securitate, were still in charge and in control. Ceausescu, as the head of it, had been sacrificed. But the whole system around, you know, the oppression of rights and the control of people was completely in place. So after 2 years in Romania...
Sorry, how did you end up in Romania? Had you been in college?
I had been in college. I went to Maynooth. Okay. And then I finished... Kim and a small Irish charity called Hand to Heart. I volunteered with them, fundraised myself back at home, went out, came back to Ireland and knew at that point this was all I was ever going to do. And
so on the basis of your experience in Romania?
It was life-changing.
How did the Romanians react to an Irish fellow coming out? And how do you, I mean, how many people were able to speak English? What were you?
I spoke
to?
Romanian.
You spoke Romanian?
Yeah.
So. Have you a knack for picking up languages?
I did. Like when I lived in the southern Philippines, I speak fluent Visayan to this day, which is the language of the southern Philippines. So I think I had a better knack of it when I was a bit younger, is the honest truth of it. I think as we get older, it gets a bit tougher. So I've been learning Vietnamese for the last 3 years. When I lived in Hanoi, returned back to Ireland just in July. And I did notice in myself that my Vietnamese did not proceed at the same level.
I think you've been a bit hard on yourself.
That's my Romanian or my or my Visayan, Matt, is the truth of it. Yeah, but I suppose for me then,
is this because when you're immersed in a culture, you just have to pick up the language, and you do, and you just have a knack for doing that?
I think for me, if you're working with communities, that translation doesn't work. Like, for me anyway, when I lived in Romania and I worked with refugees in a huge camp, these were refugees from all over the world who had been caught in Romania. So we had, you know, refugees from, you know, the Gulf, so from Iraq and Iran, from the Iraq-Iran war.
In Romania? I was never aware that this happened.
Tamils who had, you know, and Sinhalese from Sri Lanka, Somalis.
How did they end up in Romania?
They were on smuggling routes from Eastern Europe into Western Europe, and were caught in Romania and then in large camps, but were just basically put in a camp and left. And, you know, so we had a street children's program. We had an outreach program for families in trouble in Bucharest who had no food supplies, etc. And we had a program of support into this refugee camp. So it was a very interesting time. Like, I look back on myself, I was young, maybe didn't understand the full politics of the country, but was interested. Learning the language taught me a lot about the politics of the country, because people would then have conversations with you about what was going on, which they wouldn't in English. Came back to Ireland and knew this was what I was going to do for life. And then at the time, the Columban Fathers, who are based there in Dalgan Park near Navan, were looking to get volunteers to work on some of their overseas programs, and were finding it difficult to get volunteers because they were looking for a 4-year commitment up front as a volunteer. So you can imagine that's a big commitment to give up front. It's a big chunk of your life at that time when you're in your 20s. So I volunteered for their program. So I knew it would be 4 years, and I spent most of that time in the southern Philippines during the war on the island of Mindanao, which is about the size of Ireland, but was in the midst of the conflict between the government and Muslim separatist groups who wanted Mindanao to break away from the Philippines. So it was an ugly, low-intensity conflict. And I loved living there in terms of the work that we were doing. I was working with farmers particularly, and particularly working around land rights. So when I came back to Ireland, so that was most of my 20s, to be honest.
Sorry, can I just ask you there, I mean, because you mentioned the Columbans and you went to Maynooth, is there a religious reason for doing this?
There was. I think I came from a family that, you know, church was important in our family.
Yeah.
And for me, that was how I saw myself, was giving back socially. I wouldn't say it was overtly religious.
No, because I ask, because you mentioned the Columbines, and Trokara would have a reputation as being a Catholic church organization.
Yeah. And I find that value system sits very well with my own value system. So Trokara founded by the Bishops' Conference, but on the basis of Catholic social teaching is the underpinning values of the organization. And I found those values, you know, like dignity of every human person, the values around justice, the values around peace, to be completely aligned with my own values when I worked with the Columbans. And then when I joined Trokara, when I came back to Ireland, one of the reasons I think that I chose to join Trokara was because of that easy match of personal values. So before I left the Philippines, I'd worked on a large campaign with a group of farmers called the Mapalad Farmers. So if you can imagine, they had lived in this area of land in Mindanao for countless generations. They couldn't even count the generations back. but they had never had land title. These were indigenous communities living in a rural area, and their title had been their land had been given to large investors, not even from the island, on the basis that they went to court and they got legal title for the land. And we started a huge campaign for these farmers. And the solution to that was not to say we're going to provide aid to these people long term because they've now been pushed off their land. And I suppose it brought to me a whole new understanding of what poverty is really about, which is not just the absence of things or the absence of material things. It's fundamentally an absence of voice and an absence of power for many, many communities. So when I started working with these farmers, it was about making sure we put pressure on this company and on the people who had made that decision that they get back on their land. And it ended up in a huge national campaign. You know, the farmers organised a hunger strike that got huge political interest, put pressure on the president of the country at the time, Fidel Ramos, to get involved and to make decisions around land rights for indigenous communities. And so in a sense, the reason I joined Throkra wasn't just that I felt my own values completely matched, but also it was an organisation that brought both perspectives, which is the perspective around when people are in need, we react and we bring immediate aid. It's life-saving. But we also ask the deeper questions around why people are poor and the underlying systemic issues around poverty. And that always interested me deeply. So when I think about the work that I've done with Throkra ever since, it has been those two tracks. If I think about, you know, the work, for example, being in Guatemala when the Supreme Court finally declared that there was a genocide against the indigenous communities in Guatemala. And I remember standing outside the Supreme Court as these women came out and they had spent 20 years fighting for justice that their own government would even recognise what had happened to them as indigenous communities. And we were involved in funding and supporting that work for decades alongside local organisations. So to me, it has always been that respond to need, but also ask the underlying questions. And in Throkra, I think that's what we do. We do both. And that's what makes my sort of fit for the organisation so perfect. So if you talk about, you know, where your values are completely aligned, that's where I find it.
You're back living in Ireland now, though.
Yes,
yeah. Are you going to find Ireland completely boring by comparison with all these parts of the world?
So I moved back just a couple of months ago. Bit of a shock, the weather, the climate at the moment, the temperature. But I think I don't find it boring because, number one, I'm working in an organisation that does this work that we do globally. And I can see the big picture. I can see the contribution that I try and make with my colleagues around the world to the work that Throkra does. And that's where I see my bit of the puzzle now is to lead the organisation and to try and lead it through a time of huge change and turmoil globally.
When you're back in Ireland, though, do you think are we a bit soft maybe here in Ireland and that we complain about an awful lot and don't realise how good we actually have it by comparison with many parts of the world?
I think when I first came back to Ireland, that was my view, honestly, Matt. Like, as a young man coming back from what I had seen in Romania, coming back from what I'd seen in the Philippines, I was very much, you know, if I listen to The Last Word, for example, and somebody's on and they're, you know, the traffic in Galway or, whatever, you know, or people in Longford, you know, that was me. I was like, what in the name of God is wrong with people? Can they not see how good we have it? But then I suppose with experience and life, you learn that everyone has their problems every place.
It's their own circumstances that they deal with every day.
And
rather
it's
than other people's circumstances somewhere else.
Yeah, and actually there's a lot of shared, like if I sit under a mango tree in Uganda now and I talk to rural farmers, they're talking about similar things that the lads at home in Longford are talking about. They're talking about the price of cattle, or they're talking about, you know, the challenges of local services. So the circumstances might be different, But actually, there's a huge amount of similarity in what people talk about. And people talk about the concerns that they have in life. So I suppose what life has taught me over that period of time is when I leave Ireland and come back, is that you meet people where they're at. And those are the things that matter. And if you're stuck in traffic because you can't get to work or you can't pick up your kids from childcare, or life is so expensive for you, that is a legitimate and real problem for people. In the same way, you know, as if you're sitting under a mango tree in Somalia and you're thinking the water pump has broken down and we don't have clean water. So that's how I've sort of come to see it and been able to, I suppose, live in different countries and then move back home periodically from time to time.
We spend a lot of time in this country considering what's been going on in Gaza recently and the horrors there and the genocide there. But are we then guilty at the same time of ignoring things going on in the world which are equally as terrible, equally as important, perhaps even worse in some respects? You've mentioned South Sudan, for example, which, and we're guilty of this in the last word as much as anybody else, we don't cover it because possibly we perceive people aren't interested in it.
Yeah, to me, what has been striking since coming back is, like, obviously there's been huge coverage on Ukraine and the illegal Russian invasion of Ukraine, which was right. There's been huge coverage of Gaza, you know, the genocide, the level of killing, but the level of destruction and just the place now where Palestinians are left. And maybe also not as much concentration on the underlying causes around it, particularly around the occupation and the constant encroachment of settlements into the West Bank and East Jerusalem. That is, I think it's fantastic that that's been covered so widely and is constantly debated. I think the one that's maybe not so much on our radar now is Sudan. So the civil war in Sudan has led to the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. 12 million people displaced, many of them within the country. 25 million in need of food aid and support. That's half the population. And a level of violence and killing that's hard to imagine. So if you think about what's happened in the last few weeks, one of the parties to the conflict, the RSF, have surrounded the city of Al-Fashir and starved it out. It's almost like a medieval siege, like what you would read about from medieval European history. They surrounded it for 500 days. They starved the city out. They killed anybody coming out. And then they finally took the city 2 weeks ago. And I think the reports coming out that we're beginning to see of levels of killing and levels of sexual violence against women are all true as they've taken that city. And now they're moving towards the Kordofans, which is the area that we as Throkra work in. Two cities there are next for the same treatment. They are being encircled at the moment and they will be starved, killed over the next number of weeks, months ahead. So I think the level of violence in Sudan has largely gone unnoticed in international media. We've tried our best to bring attention to it. Like this Christmas, that's what we're focusing on as we go out to the Irish public again. We're focusing on children in conflict and we're particularly focusing on Sudan.
And what will you be able to do?
Okay, so again, there's going to be two approaches to this. The first is we're able to work in the Kordofans at the moment. We're able to get aid in through our local organisations, run nutrition centres and run health centres so that immediate needs of people who are fleeing. So if you can imagine that area, Kordofan, the two Kordofan states has a population of about 2 million people, but they've about 1.2 million extra who have been displaced from other parts of Sudan into that area.
And are they living in refugee camps?
Living in a mixture of camps and communities, some taken in by communities, some living in camps. But now the war is coming there and it's coming quickly. And where all these people are going to go within the context of the Nuba Mountains and the Kordofans remains to be seen. So I think, first of all, we will be working on the ground to provide immediate support, but we'll also be working on the advocacy side. Like, I think what is needed is that, number one, that we draw more attention to Sudan and more political attention. Number two, that the outside parties to the conflict, who have been supporting the flow of arms in, despite the sanctions, that they are put under pressure to
seize.
Where
are the arms coming from? Who's using them and where are they coming from?
So if you take the RSF, who are committing the atrocities across Darfur last couple of weeks and are now moving to the Kurdifans, most of their supply of arms is coming from United Arab Emirates. They are the main suppliers of the arms to the RSF.
Why are the United Arab Emirates supplying them with this?
Lots of theories around this, but certainly one is that the RSF control large gold mines in Darfur and that all of this gold has been routed out of Sudan to the Emirates, and that there's economic interests and political interests in supporting one side to the conflict. But what is happening is that these political moves have meant that the two parties, the SAF and the RSF, are getting arms. The fighting is continuing, and it has led to a humanitarian catastrophe that's unimaginable for people.
Sometimes, you know, the history of the world shows that third parties get involved, often the United States and other parties going in and using their own armaments to overpower the local fighters. And that doesn't work, as we've seen in so many places. But what does work? Is it just making sure that, whatever reasons, that these warring factions can't manufacture their own weapons, that they can't get them from somewhere else? Or is it that if they can't get them from somewhere else, they'll just find other ways of killing people anyway?
That's partly true, as Rwanda showed, you know, during the genocide, you know, ways of killing people without guns was certainly found. However, what we are seeing, and this is where sophisticated weaponry is now coming in, like we're seeing constant drone strikes now on humanitarian convoys in Sudan. So that city of Al-Fashir, when WFP convoys, so World Food Programme trucks, going to try and bring aid to famine regions, so regions that are declared under famine, constantly hit by drone strikes. So what we're seeing now is weaponry is more sophisticated. We're seeing that if you want to starve a population, drones are a much better way of doing it than having to go over a vast, vast area with young men with guns. So I think it is the level of sophisticated weaponry that's now coming into these situations. And just the lack of humanitarian access, even in situations that are under famine, is because of the level of weaponry, artillery and drones that are now available in these conflicts. So I think it needs to be both. We need to respond to the needs of communities, but we need political pressure on the warring parties and on those who support them.
It sounds almost like an intractable situation, one that's insoluble. But you're the glass half full person.
I am.
You believe and that this can be dealt with and
I
stopped.
I do think it can be stopped. Like, if you look back at some of the conflicts that we've seen, we would have said the same. Like, having been in Rwanda a lot after the genocide, you would have said that was completely intractable. But things have improved and things have built back. So, like, we do need the fighting to stop. And one of the things, I suppose, we as Trokra have been talking to other parties about is to bring political pressure on the two warring factions. We need a ceasefire, first of all. We need this constant circling of cities and starving them to stop. And then we need humanitarian access. And then there is going to have to be a peace process between the two protagonists and between the two main groups, the SAF and the RSF. How that plays out over time remains to be seen. But we did see a horrendously difficult conflict in South Sudan manage at least to a ceasefire was brokered and the fighting and the killing stopped. And then life can start again once that happens. So that's how I would view it, that it's not easy. It's difficult. Diplomatic efforts around bringing the two parties to the table are going to be necessary. But the killing has to stop.
Of course, what happens in large parts of Africa and Asia, whatever, does arrive on our doorstep when we have immigrants arriving, particularly seeking refugee status. What do you think of the current debate that's going on in Ireland and the pressure that seems to be mounting within government, on government, to restrict the numbers who are seeking asylum here in Ireland?
Well, first of all, I'm very new to it, just back a few weeks. What I would say from our perspective on this is that if we look at what's happening globally around aid flows, there is a connection here. So what we are seeing in the immediate is a complete collapse of the funding towards countries where they are dealing with large numbers of people living in poverty. And as that continues, that is a huge push factor, particularly from sub-Saharan Africa. So if I look at the last year or so, started with USAID, which you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, I was just wanting to get to that.
Yeah. Yes. So the Elon Musk Doge dismantlement of USAID that happened was unprecedented. Like, USAID was one of the largest humanitarian funders globally. Huge amount of money going into health systems, particularly in poorer African countries, and a huge amount of money going into humanitarian response. Largely, completely wrecked and dismantled, not just in terms of stopping the money, but also in terms of the staff of USAID completely dismantled. And at the same time, what we've had is huge cuts across all the traditional European donors, between 25 and 40% reductions in development aid budgets. Germany, the UK, 40% reduction, Sweden, Belgium, right across the board. So what we've seen is a huge collapse in funding. And I suppose my concern on this is that when I think back, we talked about when I started in development, Matt. So in 1992, there was 5.3 billion people on the planet. About 35% lived in extreme poverty based on the data at the time. Today, we've about 8 billion people on the planet, about 10% living in extreme poverty based on the World Bank data. That is, for the first time, I think, in generations, that is going to increase and explode massively. And there is going to be then a push factor around migration out of countries where poverty is going to explode. And that is because we're seeing these cuts are going to have a massive, massive impact. The second thing that's happening is the climate crisis is particularly hitting poorer countries. Agriculture is under massive pressure because of increasing temperatures, and also droughts and floods and cycles are increasing, making rain-fed agriculture much more difficult for communities. And then we've got the third aspect of conflict. So for me, the migration crisis is only starting for us in some ways, where as poverty level grows and as more and more young people in particular are willing to make the perilous trip from sub-Saharan Africa across Northern Africa and across the Mediterranean, this is going to remain a big challenge for us in all the countries in Europe. And it is interesting to me that at a time when we're facing this challenge, that with the exception of Ireland, that most countries are devastating their overseas aid programs. And Ireland is an exception on this one. Ireland is one of the only countries, and to give huge credit to the Irish government, in the last budget, the Minister Neil Richmond brought a proposal for an increase in overseas development assistance, which was signed off in the last budget. So I know we on our side of the table, on the NGO side, want Ireland to reach the gold standard of 0.7% of GNI, and we'll always call for it, etc. But at a time when aid programs are being devastated globally, I think Ireland is an outlier.
You mentioned NGO there, first time you mentioned it, and this is now a buzzword in social media for the far right and those who deny they're far right, who behave like far right. What do you make of this sustained assault that there is on non-governmental organisations who try and do charitable work, who try to do social justice, who are not just dismissed, but who are angrily confronted?
Yeah, I think what I see globally now is that the space has narrowed massively for all of our work, and particularly for those who work on rights. So if you can see from, say, the end of the Second World War, there has been the slow advancement of rights, and they've been hard won in many places. But what we're now seeing is the complete undermining of multilateralism and the complete undermining of the rights of civil society actors to participate and play a part in their own societies. And this is happening globally and it's happening at country level. So when I see, for example, some of the local organisations we work with, you know, I had to close the Throkra programme in Pakistan a number of years ago. I never got full adequate reasons as to why that happened, but I do think that Throkra's work on gender was a big, big part of why we were kindly asked to leave Pakistan. We've had to close much of our work in Nicaragua for the same reason, because human rights work is very, very difficult in that context. I look at some of the organisations that we work with now in places like Zimbabwe on human rights, and it is increasingly difficult to operate. So two things are happening. I think globally, there is a targeting of organisations that stand up for rights. What the Israeli government have the moves in the last number of months that target human rights organisations within Israel, and now the US government rolling in behind that and beginning to sanction organisations because they are part of taking Israel to the International Criminal Court of Justice. That is part of a movement that is around trying to stop particularly organisations that work for human rights and work for rights more broadly, be it climate, gender, human rights, to stop them doing their work and to curtail them with all sorts of legal registrations, all sorts of, I suppose, restrictions in country, and also then political pressure from outside to stop them doing their work. So I worry at the moment. And I suppose the lesson I've taken, I'm going back to my glass half full here, Matt, but what I worry at the moment is that this global movement around curtailing organisations that work in social justice, that our role at the moment is that I think there are times when there is space to advance rights. And I've seen that in many of the country programmes we run. I then think there are times where the space is so restricted that all you can really do is keep the lights on with those organisations.
It's defend.
And I really feel at the moment, particularly with the Trump administration, with the way those policies from the US are now being deployed globally, I think we're in a defence period of time. It's hunker down. It's help those organisations to call out the abuses they see and to defend the territory and the rights that were hard won.
Sean Farrell is Chief Executive of Throkra. It's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you very much for joining us on Magnified.
Thank you very much.
Magnified with Matt Cooper. Sponsored by Intact Insurance, the new name for RSA Insurance. Offering personal and commercial cover with ease.
Go loud. Sounds better with us.
We've all done it. Stock our fridge with leafy greens and good intentions, only to have our future self sacrifice quality nutrition for the convenience of takeout. Keep your body and mind nourished all day with a whole body meal shake from Kachava. It's got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. But the best part? It actually tastes delicious. With 6 indulgent flavors to choose from, it's easy to make a superfood-packed shake. From chocolate, vanilla, and chai, to matcha, coconut acai, and strawberry, you've got endless ways to personalize your Kachava. Whether you prefer it straight up or enjoy adding fruit, peanut butter, nut milk, or even iced coffee, with every 2 scoops of Kachava, you're getting 85 plus superfoods, nutrients, and plant-based ingredients. Shop now through December 2nd to get 30% off your first purchase of 2 or more bags with code NEWS at kachava.com. That's 30% off for a limited time at kachava.com, code NEWS.